Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Conversation isn't, yes, I agree, brilliant. Yes, I agree, brilliant. Well, join me next time and keep leading the company where I agree with people. And also I think it's a really good sign when you know people who disagree with you.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Balancing Acts. In this conversation, I talk to comedian and writer Athena Cableno. Hello, I'm Steve Whiteley and welcome to Balancing Acts, a series of conversations with an array of creatives. We talk about their journey, the struggles they faced whilst progressing their career, strategies they use to unlock their creativity, how they balance their career with their personal lives, what impact this has had on their mental health, and lots more. Athena was a member of the BBC Comedy Writers Room 2019 to 2020. She was also awarded the BBC Felix Dexter Bursary for BAME Up and Coming Comedy Writers in 2020. She's written for the likes of Horrible Histories, The Russell Howard Show, Radio 4's The Lenny Henry Show, Dead Ringers, News Quiz, News Jack, The Now Show, and she was also the lead writer for Sketchtopia. Athena is also the founding member of Do The Right Scene, a London-based improv group, and she's featured as a guest on Mock The Week and is a regular co-host of The Guilty Feminist. She also writes pieces for The Guardian, Time Out, and Stylist magazine, and is the host of her podcast, Keeping Athena Company. And remember, if you like this episode, if you like Balancing Acts, then please do rate and review it on Apple. That would be lovely. Absolutely lovely. Oh, and one thing that I haven't been plugging, but I've decided I'm going to from now on, is my mailing list. If you would like to keep up to date with everything I'm up to, then you can just head to my website, stevewhiteley.co. That's WHITELEY.co. And you'll see there a little thing will pop up, a little message to subscribe to my newsletter and just type in your email address. And hey presto, then you will be definitely not spammed. You'll just be updated on a pleasant sort of weekly basis. Nothing more than that, I assure you. And that's it. That's it for now. That's the plugging over with. So without further ado, over to Athena.
Perfect. It's interesting, though, for people, you know, like you that are doing so many different things. It's not like a normal job. And so, like, how do you prioritize your different projects and so forth?
I prioritize them by payment, which is paying me the most and which is paying me more promptly. And I guess obviously, like, there are things that are paying nothing now, but in the future, I hope they will pay me dividends. So I try to invest time in my own projects that no one cares about at this moment in time, but they might care about in the future. I mean, I don't know. I think when you're busy with personal and professional things, a lot of it is quite instinctive. You wake up in the morning and you think, what am I going to do today? And that will be dictated by a huge range of factors, like, you know, what's conflicting, what's necessary, what's unnecessary, what is an indulgence, what someone is waiting for, what's overdue. A lot of it is just, I'm an incessant list maker. I've got lists on my mobile phone. I've got lists on my laptop. I've got paper lists. All kinds of lists, and I just work.
Do you use any listing apps or software like
Wanderlist? I don't know, no, nothing.
Oh, you would
nothing
love
more complicated.
Like, I used Evernote. To use Wanderlist. Evernote's
really
great.
Yeah, I tried using Evernote. I don't like to complicate it. I like a really? Very unengineered list of things. I do have a bullet journal. my bullet journal, I look at it every month and I have headlines for every month that I'm like, these are the big ticket things I've got to do every month. So bullet journals will be the most organizing I do, but I don't even do it properly. Like,
right.
I don't have like future log and all that shit that you're supposed to do. But lots of lists and every day, lots of like, you know, committing to a kind of today I'm going to achieve X, Y, and Z. And then you just stumble along.
And then you tick it off at the end of the day if you've done
it. Oh, I love ticking off. I love crossing things off a list. Yeah, that's one of my favourite things, crossing things off a list. So that's a lovely bit of serotonin boost for me.
Yeah. And so with stand-up out the way now, have you then just been shifting the majority of your focus now on writing and developing projects, scripted?
Yes. So it was really, I've been saying this a lot on the record, it was really fortunate for me to be writing or to be stepping up and writing when I did, because I'm, you know, I didn't foresee the pandemic, but when it came, I already had lots of stuff teed up just randomly. So I was really fortunate. Had I not been investing time in developing that side of the craft, so we say,
I'd have
been fucked. I'd have been really fucked, to put it bluntly. Bluntly and accurately. And generally speaking, I mean, I hate to say this because I love stand-up. It's my first love. But I think people want writers more than stand-ups, and to the point where they want stand-ups to be writers.
Mm.
You know, most stand-ups will know, and you'll perform yourself, most people will know when they perform, they'll meet people in industry, and then people in the industry won't say, come and do 20 minutes for me. They'll say, do you have a script?
Mm.
You know, they'll say, do you want to contribute to the sketch show? Or maybe do you want to do panel show work, which isn't stand-up, which you have to remember. So it pains me to say it because we spend so long learning how to be stand-ups and putting so much time and effort into it. But, you know, the script writing work tends to lead to more work. Whereas when you do a comedy set and you're really good, you get off the stage and that's kind of the end of it. But you do a writing job and you do really good, your name gets said in another room and then you get another offer. So writing work tends to breed writing work. Stand-up just tends to breed depression and angst and all kinds of things. But it's a little harder to move. I think it's a little harder to move forward. And also that's to do with the fact that writing's so much harder. So I think when people find a good writer, that feel the tendency is to kind of value that skill a bit more, whereas there's way more stand-ups than there are writers. So stand-up's hard, but also there's loads of us. I mean, I have to concede that. There's loads of us fighting a few spaces.
Yeah, I guess there is, but then there's probably different elements, I guess, of skill sets, right?
Mm,
so
yes.
The ones right at the top, that's not easy to accomplish that level of, let's say, expertise and, you know, and skill sets. And I guess the same applies to writing. There's lots of writers, but there's writers of different abilities. And something like, for instance, it just came to the top of my head, Succession. I watched that and I was just like, wow.
That's incredible. Yeah.
How did that come out of his brain?
And well, we know how it came out. I don't know if you're aware, it's pretty much the Murdoch story.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's how, but it's really clever how they've done it, I guess.
Brilliant. It's brilliant. Did you see the Murdoch documentary on iPlayer?
That's exactly what I watched, funny enough. Yeah.
Right.
Then it's amazing how it's amazing how they copied it, but they didn't. It wasn't like Diana, a Channel 5 Diana documentary, you know, it was still its own story. And I love what they did with the son. I just love his story arc. It's
the,
so great.
The rebellious son.
Yeah, the one who was supposed to get it, then he didn't get it. And he went a bit
mad.
That's
what I mean. Yeah, I was trying not to do a spoiler. I was like,
That was a spoiler. You can edit that.
It's fine. Yeah, it's
an old show now. It got BAFTA.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's out there.
If you haven't seen it by now, you're done. But that, I just thought his story arc was great. Old Scottish guy. I should remember his name. Just such a great actor.
Brian Cox.
The writing on Succession is just outstanding. Yeah,
it's phenomenal. So now that you have you've moved into this world and lockdown has changed things for everyone. Obviously, we've hardly done any stand up. Do you think when things eventually start to go back to some level of normality, you'll continue down this path, or will you spend your time equally as you were between writing and stand up?
I'd like to think I'd go back to performing, probably not as often.
Okay.
And probably not. There are probably things that I might have said yes to a year and a half ago that I might not say yes to now, purely because the time I have other ways I can fill that time I would spend. So, for example, I had a gig in Glastonbury, actually, which is a lovely gig, which I was going to do, I think, the March or April of the lockdown starting, and obviously it got cancelled.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that I don't know if I'd go back to that if they rebooked it. You know, like, it's a 3.5-hour drive to get there, and then you're on stage 20 minutes, and it's a 3.5-hour drive to get back. And in that time, there were probably other things that I could achieve. So it's, yeah, I think having more things to compete in for my time means I would think twice about some of those long drives, you know, for not that much, for, you know, it's not that you don't get paid a huge amount of money for a lot of stand-up. And then when you do get paid a huge amount of money, sometimes by the time you pay for your hotel, your fuel, your babysitter, or your incidentals, there's not a huge amount left. Mm-hmm. So it's sadly become a practical reality means I probably would spend a lot less time on the circuit rather than I'd love to do what I used to do before, but it makes less practical sense now.
Yeah. And also I think there's a case we said for sometimes you've got to go where the momentum is. And
yes,
from what I can sense with you, there's a lot of momentum on the writing side, and you're in demand now as a TV writer on scripted and non-scripted projects, and it's difficult to go against that when that energy's there.
Yeah, you've got to say yes to what people are asking you to do.
Sure.
So, you know, people are asking me to write, so I have to say yes to that. And I think, like I said, work breeds work. So writing work breeds work. People obviously aren't asking any of us to do stand-up. Obviously there's a bit of TV work and a bit of radio work, but not a huge amount. So there's nothing to say yes to. And it's weird, I don't know how. I mean, what's going to happen when lockdown stops? So the comedy club's just going to come running to us? Like, what's going to happen? It's going to be a weird time for a lot of, and also the circuit's going to shrink. There's a lot of places that won't be booking. There's a lot, you know, and people will go to, like, what I'm trying to say, I think there'll be fewer spots and people will just want reliable comics. They're not going to be like, yeah, let's get some fresh talent in. Not that I'm a fresh talent. I'm pretty around for a fairly, you know, bit now, but you know, there's going to be, people are going to be more reluctant, I think, to maybe put on acts that they feel they don't know so well, or acts that they don't feel are established. They want the old standards, the people who have just been on the circuit for 15, 20 years, even longer than that. So with that reality as well, it makes sense to just say writer-comedian as opposed to comedian-writer.
Yeah, it's that sort of forever dilemma of trying to figure out what to call yourself, because I switch it up all the time.
Yeah. You're a poet, right?
I mean, I would never call myself that. I would say character comedian if it came to stand up, but then sometimes I do stand up not in character, so, and then outside of, similar to you, do other things as well. So I don't know. I mean, those days are gone now, I think. Unless you've got like a 9-to-5 job, you don't need to necessarily define what you are. You're different things according to the people you're working with and the projects that you're working on, right?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think the beautiful thing about stand-up, and that's why I definitely encourage people who want to be creative but don't know what to do. The beautiful thing about stand-up is it's kind of like an access all areas pass to different creative endeavors. Do you know what I mean? Like,
totally.
Amazing how you can get into acting through stand-up, you can get into script writing through stand-up, you can get into plays through stand-up, you can get into being in adverts and earning yourself 20k for a day's work through stand-up. You know, there's huge, you can become a writer. So many people have written books over lockdown, it's unbelievable. So the word comedian now just means you do something that makes people laugh at some point. You know, sketch writer, you could be a social media influencer. And having started off in stand-up. So definitely keep an open, I think it's good that we keep an open mind as to what we are and what we do.
100%.
Ultimately, we have to create stuff and we got paid for it and we've got to get paid for it. And that's the best way to do it. Just like keep an open mind.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. That was, I think, the biggest attraction for me, because before I was working in music and I was doing radio presenting and those that kind of things. And I felt there was a certain level of restriction in terms of creativity, and I was like, what is the thing that I can do? And I've been doing improv, but once you get into comedy and you sort of start moving in that direction, and then the doors open, and it really is like you can do anything, really, if you decide to. Obviously,
yeah,
work harder.
I, I'm just amazed at some of the places I found myself and some of the things I found myself doing. And it all started off because I spent 5 minutes on a stage, you know, saying silly, telling silly jokes about nonsense. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, yeah. I'm like, wow, starting from that small bit of nonsense that used to, you know, I used to stand on the stage and play to silence, and there'd be like three people in the room and a dog, and, you know, and it just, and that was a, like sort of 7 or 8 years ago. And now it's like, oh, now I do all this stuff that I never would have dreamed of. So comedy does lead you to strange places that you never have imagined.
Yeah.
But only if your mind is open to kind of faking it till you make it. So I mean, like, it's just like, oh, Athena, do you want to come in this writer's room? Yeah. Okay. I don't know if I can do that, but I'll try. Or do you want to do improv? Okay, yeah, sure, why not? But yeah, so you definitely, there's definitely a bit of faking it till you make it when you open yourself to all these labels that you're not necessarily qualified to do.
When you dip your toes in the water and to that new endeavor, do you suffer from imposter syndrome? And if so, how do you just forge ahead?
Yeah, I suffer from imposter syndrome from the old endeavors. Like, even in my old day job, I had imposter syndrome. I think I'm starting to think that, I don't know if anyone psychologically or academically studied it. I'm starting to think that it's just, I think cavemen got it. You know what I mean? Like, should I be chasing a lion? Maybe I should be eating vegetables. Like, I just feel like it's a natural human instinct to have a helicopter moment where you float up outside your body and you look down and you think, this doesn't feel right. I'm not good enough, or whatever. And that comes from respecting the art form, because, you know, mm-hmm. I've seen Chris Rock at the O2, and I saw him years and years ago. So obviously before I'd even thought of being a comedian, and now I'm a comedian. So it's like, knowing I've got the same job title as this guy that I paid 70 quid to see like 10 years ago. That's weird, right? Okay, fine. I'm not at the O2. No one's paying 70 quid to see me. But the point is, we got the same job title, right? So that's going to give you imposter syndrome. And my answer of how to get over it, and so this is always my answer, is that just have a conversation with yourself before any of this happened. Mm. You know, have a conversation with yourself 10 years ago. And that person 10 years ago wouldn't have imagined that they'd be writing for like Lenny Henry or... You know, I just got sent a food hamper from a client. This hamper, I'm on a fucking diet because I have the baby weight, and I just got sent cheese and wine and all sorts of shit from a happy customer. And this customer is somebody I would never imagine even knowing my name, you know, even a year ago. So that's what I do. I tell you, what would 30-year-old Athena be really impressed by when they have a conversation with 39-year-old Athena? And it's like, oh, okay. Now, don't get me wrong. There were so many more things that I need to achieve. So it's almost like you have to have a conversation with your past self, and then you have to have a conversation with your future self to make sure you never rest on your laurels. But that conversation with your past self is really important, especially when you come, I don't know what your background is, but because I have a very professional background and I didn't have to leave it, like, there was nothing wrong with my job. I always have to remember that I did this because it's for a reason, because it's worth it. So, okay, fine, the old Athena probably had a bit more money and was a bit more financially secure and all that stuff. But at the same time, like, this life is way more Instagrammable.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
It's a way more Instagrammable life, you know, and no one was sending me fucking hampers when I was 30 years old, so, and no one was gonna. So that just happened today. It was a really nice surprise. So that's what I do. That'd be my advice to anyone who's got imposter syndrome. And most people do have it. It's a normal thing. It's normal.
Yeah, and you can... It's very easy to fall into the trap of thinking that this is just how I'm feeling and everyone else in the room is super confident right now. You could be in a writer's room and sort of trying to pluck up the courage to say something, but inevitably there's going to be other people sitting around that table that are also thinking the same thing.
Yeah, and I think it's not about having it or not having it. It's about dealing with it or not dealing with it. I was, funny enough, I was having a conversation yesterday with the manager, and what I come to the conclusion was that I still feel the same insecurities as I did a year ago or 2 years ago, but the difference now is like I've just achieved a bit more, you know. So when I think to myself, I don't want to say this, I feel stupid, I think, hold on a minute, I've got credentials now, you know. So it's almost like as you progress, you can find practical and compelling arguments that defeat the imposter syndrome. Does that make sense? Because you've got imposter syndrome, but look at what you did last month, or look what you did last year, or look at what's going on. Whereas I think, so it's not like it gets better, but it becomes, in the imposter syndrome, becomes more incredulous as you get on. So it's just always really important to just be really realistic about you know, what you're capable of, not from a sense of belief, but from a sense of, this is my CV. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so totally.
Just always at the forefront of your mind, have your credentials sat there waiting to propel your propel words out of your mouth when those feelings of doubt creep in.
Yeah.
Which is what I've been doing recently. Just like, oh, okay, this is a career now. And it's not a made up career. You know, it was a made up career a few years ago. I was just like bullshitting my way into places. But now I'm not bullshitting my way into places. It's actual, there's actual kind of, there's real work that underpins that. And, you know, there's a whole body of work emerging. So, but it's a long slog. And when I say that, there'll be a room that I'll be in 2 months' time where that body of work is insignificant and I'll be back to square one again.
But that's, it's very up and down. For sure. That's the thing that I've been thinking about. There's just levels. There's always levels. And that fine line between being a combination of grateful, but also giving yourself a pat on the back for how far you've come, but then also not resting on your laurels and go, yeah, this is good, but I'm not getting too big for my boots because there's so many more levels.
Yeah, it's like that guy who climbed El Capitan a couple of years ago and he didn't use any ropes. And it's like, getting halfway up there is a really big achievement. Do you know what I mean? It's like, wow. But then you can't really stop because you're going to fall off the bloody El Capitan and die. Yeah. You know, so it's like, it's a little bit like that. It's like free climbing, and every kind of meter you climb is an achievement. But the risk is still there of like falling off and, you know, be trending on Twitter for the wrong reasons. So you have to and that's what I mean about having a conversation with your future self. Just like, this is great, you're doing really well, so what do you want 45-year-old Athena to be proud of?
Yeah.
And that's quite a constructive thing to do, and as long as it's realistic, you can be crazy ambitious and all, but make it realistic and modest as well, and that's a good thing too.
Going back to you getting into comedy, because one of the first big things is actually deciding to do it. Mm. You were, if I'm not mistaken, you're working in the public sector prior to comedy.
I was doing all sorts, yeah.
Right, okay.
I should be really frank. I only quit my full-time job last November. So I've spent a long time doing both things kind of full-time. But yeah, I was doing all kinds of stuff up until last November, yeah.
And what was it that made you decide in the first place to give stand-up a go? Were you the type of person that was always the joker of your friends, or was it just more of an inquisitive thing to see, yeah, I want to give this a go, see if I'm any good at it?
It's funny. I wasn't a joker, but I was always the funny one.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? So it was like, it wasn't like, oh, he's a female, she's a bagger, she's a laugh, innit? It wasn't like that at all. But I was always the person who would say something that would be funny. You know, and I always had a sense of being able to interpret things, not differently to other people, but having a brain that would always surprise people with an angle on things that they hadn't come up with, if that makes sense. So if we were having a conversation, I'd be the one to say something that would make people go, you know, in a random kind of way. And the kind of thing that I'd do it and people on the bus would be laughing as well at what I'd said or whatever. And I'd always kind of been aware of that. That's been like a lifelong thing. Like, Athena is funny. And then for a little while, this is a true story, actually. For 8 years ago, I used to work in this place and I had this manager who sat opposite me. And I basically made him laugh every day just because it's just one of those things. And he was like, what are you doing here? Why don't you just try doing something? Why don't you try to do something creative? And I was like, all right, then. But I never did anything with that for ages. I didn't do anything with it at all. And then one day I did. And that was the end of it. It sounds very boring, but I did. Oh, another thing was money. I needed a bit of money and I saw how much money like top comedians are making. And I thought, you know, all my whole life, everyone's been saying that, you know, your brain is different. You're funny. And there's these people who I don't think are very funny who are like earning millions and millions and millions. So why am I here in this office? You know, not earning millions when I could just be earning. And obviously I learned very quickly that they didn't just go to a pub, perform 5 minutes and then get onto Live at the Apollo. So I learned that quite quickly. The thing about stand-up is once you realize you're good at it, you have to be humble with it as well at the beginning, because you're never good at it at the beginning, you're shit. But once you realize you've kind of got the tools required to get good at it, and once you realize you've got maybe like the work ethic, and then I had the, my life fitted comedy really well. I had a decent job, I had a car, I didn't have any kids at that time. So I could say yes to everything and and whatever. So once I had realized, oh, I could probably just get on with it, that's what I did, you know? And I thought to myself, oh, but I did do this one thing. I said every year I have these like goals every year. And if I meet them, I'll keep going. And if I don't meet them, I'll reconsider the time and effort I'm investing into this.
That's smart. So what sort of goals?
Oh, some of them were silly. Like, I mean, I paid for a comedy course. So one of the goals was to earn back what I paid on the course through comedy, you know, stuff like that. It's like 120 quid or something. But when you start out, as you know, you don't get paid. And then when you get paid like 20 quid. Things like get booked for 20 minutes, or if there was like a particular promoter I really liked, it'd be like, oh, get booked with that promoter. I mean, one of my goals one year was to get onto Mirth Control. You know, so these are really silly little goals. I'm sure your listeners won't know what Mirth Control is, but they're just, they promote lots of gigs in the country and the gigs are of questionable standard and they are never close. Wherever you live in the country, a Mirth Control gig is not near you. It's just weird. I don't know how they've managed to construct this kind of circuit, but it's like they put pins where all the comedians live and they put pins in all the venues and they made sure there was the maximum amount of distance between comedians and venues. It's brilliant. But the guy who runs it, Jeff's cool, is a funny guy, but it's a cool guy. But that was generally a thing. I was like, oh, there's this thing called Mirth Control. They pay you, you can perform. Okay, I want to get onto their gigs. 100%. And that was a goal for like year two or whatever.
Okay.
So it's one of those weird things. It wasn't like, I've got an origin story. It's not Planet of the Apes. You know, it's not a really good comedy origin story. It's just like, people said I was funny. I quite like the idea of being funny for money. I quite like the idea of being funny for lots of money. Turns out that doesn't work that way, but I continued because it worked quite well with my day job at the time. And and I just kept with it.
I think it is a good origin story. I think it's always inspiring when you hear of people that have, you know, they're in a normal job, whatever normal means, say an office job, and then pursue this thing out of curiosity or whatever it is, and then make a success out of it. That's quite inspiring to hear. What was your family's reaction to you getting into it? Have they been fully supportive from the off?
Yeah, so I didn't tell anyone at the beginning. I just sort of got on with it.
Smart move.
Yeah, I think so. Especially with comedy, you when you start off, you're not a comedian. You're just kind of doing it. You don't. If you went to a college and did a life drawing class, you wouldn't call yourself an artist. Like, you're doing life. So when you're on the open mic circuit and you're clean, it's like you're fresh and green. You know, I mean, very few people start off and they're like a finished product that is like a stand-up. Most people have a lot to learn. I had loads to learn, particularly as someone who didn't have a creative or performing background before. So I was very, you know, I was very shit, you know, to put it mildly. But I, like I said, I was shit, but there was like, there was stuff in, there was sweet corn in the shit. That's a terrible analogy. Awful analogy, but hopefully it makes sense.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
That were like, oh, this is usable. This is usable. There's something in here. I didn't tell anyone for that reason, because the minute you tell people stuff like that, they want to watch you or they want to know what your ambitions are, why you're doing it. And I found all of that a distraction. Something I said before, and I think this is true, is I thought if I have to tell people I'm a comedian, then I'm not really working hard enough. Do you know what I mean? But eventually, bit by bit, my family kind of found out. Like, I remember my brother got told, like one of his friends found out because they'd seen me on a flyer or something.
Okay.
And I don't know if you remember, if this happened to you, but I remember the first time someone put me on a flyer, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, like that.
Yeah.
It's not a basic thing. It's a big deal when you've been going for a few months or whatever and someone puts your face on a flyer and you've never
I've still got the first flyer.
Yeah, I've got
not yours, mine. I mean, weird,
yeah. Move the camera to, and there's like a big shrine to me. Yeah.
Framed. Yeah.
No, but it's a big deal. I'd actually, in this moment, just remembered what a big deal it was to see my face in like a glossy flyer. I'd not seen that before in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's how my brother found out. My mum found out when I was in a newspaper and someone in a church had showed it to her. Like, this is your daughter, isn't it? You know, and I think that's nice. You know, I'm a fairly private person anyway. I don't like to be questioned. And the comedy lifestyle means that, if, you know, people will question you a lot because it's fascinating to people. But it shouldn't, the first one or two, maybe 3 years of comedy is not fascinating to me. It's humiliating. It's hard work. It's, you know, you question yourself a lot. It's very unrewarding financially. So it's not the kind of thing I wanted to shout about from the rooftops. I think some of my friends knew because they came as bringers with me to that bringer gig. So your listeners will know sometimes you've got to bring a friend to perform. and they thought it was cool. But I kept my circle quite small. And it was weird. It wasn't even an intentional thing. It wasn't like, oh my God, this is a top secret. I was just like, I'm just getting on with it. And if people find out, cool. But if they don't find out, I'm not going to tell them proactively. And
it's a very healthy attitude.
I think so. The worst thing, absolutely worst thing is, you know, you get those comedy competitions, right? And people perform in them. And a lot of new acts, some of the comedy competitions you get through voting, audience voting.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So some will just bring like 30 of their friends. Yeah. I just used to think that's so ridiculous. Like, why would you want 30 of your family to think they have to be there to laugh at you? How can you call yourself a comedian? Like, if I was that person's friend, I'd be like, if you're funny, you don't need me. Like, I want to support you because you are a comedian. I don't want to support you because you're going to be one.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
I want to support you when you're there.
Yeah.
When you're not there, you need to do the work. You know, you need to do the work. And I'll support you whilst you're doing that. So I'll go to like an open mic club and I'll support you. But I'm not going to like pretend you're good. So you can just like leapfrog people who are good. So I didn't want to be that person with an army of friends and family who was like, I think it's funny. Like, I'll be funny when I'm producing art that is good enough. I'm not funny because of the amount of my friends and family that know I'm doing comedy. Does that make sense? So I had
that. It makes complete sense.
Yeah, I had that kind of mentality at the beginning. And I think that, yeah, you're right. I'm glad I did. I'm glad I didn't run around telling people because I was so bad for so long.
Have you always been this sort of grounded and sensible and mature about your approach to things, or is that something that you've developed over time?
Something I say a lot, and people who listen to my podcast will have heard me say this. I started comedy fairly late. I was 31 when I first performed, which is obviously not very old, but in the comedy world, lots of people start in their early 20s. They were teenagers. I used to meet 18-year-olds, and you know, I met Ed Hedges when he was like 17 or 18 or something. So I was mature because I was old. You know, I was 31. I had a fairly senior job. I had stuff going on. You know, I was living a slightly more, I was adulting. That's the word now. I was so, I guess I was grounded because in a weird way, I didn't really need comedy to work. So I didn't have that need to be as grandiose at, you know, with, you know, or I didn't have to be like, oh, I'm Athena, I'm a big deal. I'm like, I was a big, this is going to sound terrible, but I was like, oh, I'm already a big deal. My life's already kind of cool. I've done what most people don't get to do. I've got a career, I've got education, I've got income, I've got disposable income, I've got nice holidays twice a year, you know? So I was really fortunate in that I didn't have to kind of have sharp elbows. You know what I'm saying? That kind of sharp elbow mentality.
Yeah, you weren't riding on it.
Yeah,
you weren't riding
exactly.
But also you weren't sort of placing all your ego on it or anything like
No, no, exactly. I was already in a place where I was like, I want to be a comedian. I don't want to work in an office the rest of my life. I think entertainment is a space in which I can create the kind of future for myself that it gives me the freedom that I want, the happiness that I want, the financial rewards. And I can do the things, the personal things that I wanted to have to do in my life, that I had ambitions to do, that they were difficult to do in an office, you know? So that's what I wanted. But I also knew that the position I was in at that time was a good position. Like, I also knew that I was contracting, I had flexibility, I was respected by the people I worked for, I was able to travel, I was learning lots of cool things. So you're right, I didn't need to become a comedian to feed my ego. My ego was already being fed, and that meant that I didn't necessarily fall into those traps of kind of, you know, not necessarily fully understanding the scene and not having humility and all of that stuff.
Not posting like videos of your 5-minute sets within the first few weeks.
Yeah, but don't get me wrong. Like, I remember making like a showreel. You know? I remember making a show. There were some really bad, horrible showreels out there that we all have from, you know, from our very early days. And I remember making a website and stuff like that. So I still try to give it all that, but not to the extent that some people do. But I think also that kind of mentality held me back a little bit, because then when I did start to get quite good, I probably didn't realize how, you know, I probably didn't do what a lot of people would have done, which is just like ride that wave. I think I was way more hesitant. And if anything, I ended up working harder in my day job. the most strenuous and well-paid years of my day job were whilst I was doing comedy. So I was, and I don't know why I did that. I don't know why I put so much focus back into my day job when my comedy was going so well. I think I was just, it was financial security that was worrying me. And also not understanding the comedy scene and not understanding lots of things that I could have done that maybe I didn't do, meetings with managers and stuff like that. And social media and all that kind of stuff. But after, then eventually I was like, I kind of caught up with myself. It can bite you in the bum, too much humility. You know, it can, you have to know when to, you know, you have to know when to say you're shit and you have to know when to say you're good. That's just as important.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Talking about social media, you said before about you being, you know, a private person. Do you find that there's a tension between that and you sort of being quite active on social media and Twitter particularly?
No, I don't think there's tension at all. I'm very, I set very clear boundaries as to what I share and what I don't share. So for example, I don't really talk about my personal life in an unabstract way. You know, it's very abstract if I talk about it. I don't put people, friends and family online. So if I go out for dinner with friends, it's not going on Instagram. As in friends outside of comedy.
Okay.
Like if you're out with four friends in comedy, it's going on Instagram. Someone's, you know, someone's putting it out
there. Of course, yeah.
I try to kind of draw a line between this is stuff, this is like public realm stuff and this is private realm stuff. And so most of what I put out is kind of opinion, funny shit. Like I'll talk about funny stuff my kids do, but I won't identify them. For ages, I didn't even put their gender online. Like that was really hard work. Just always using gender online. I kept forgetting. But that's for me just commentary. I don't really put anything identifiable. Like I said, I talk about relationships. And there are some views I have that I don't put online as well. So I'm even selective about the views I have that I put online because unless someone proactively asks me some questions, I'm not going to answer them. But I think you can be very private whilst being active on social media. You can share what you want to share. No one forces us to share anything.
Sure.
I took a picture of a rainbow, right? And then I changed my mind from sharing it because I was afraid that people could identify the park. And I was like, man, what if someone could recognize this park? I don't know where I live. So I was I'm that into being very particular about what goes online. It doesn't always look it because my feed is always a bit random, but I'm quite particular about what goes online. Yeah.
Do you have like a separate social media home for stuff for friends and family? If you want to post a rainbow, you've got WhatsApp.
I've got Google Photos. Photos is great. So I've got a Google account. So that, you know, pictures that my family want to see, they can see. Like I WhatsApp you. And all my family member, and I've got something to say to you, I'll WhatsApp you. You know, I love social media. I use it a lot. I use Twitter a lot.
You're very good at it. Yeah, no, because considering what you were saying before about not being someone that in the past, when you started out, was very good at self-promoting it, I think you're really good at it in respect that you take like a few different tiered approach in terms of you state opinions, you create debate. You're not a prisoner to your own humor or trying to be a comedian all the time, which I think is quite healthy.
I like Twitter because it's stream of conscience. So I just kind of just think things and I think, oh, I'm going to tweet that.
Yeah, like and I saw you posed a very controversial question I saw recently that I just wanted to flag.
Yeah, go on.
do you think the first person to dunk a biscuit in their tea was laughed at? You know, so I wouldn't have the balls to post that.
So stuff like that is like, I genuinely think, and guess what? I would have been drinking a cup of tea, dunking a biscuit, going someone. And I just imagined like a table and people sat around the table and someone just picked up a biscuit and puts it in their tea. And everyone's like, Steve, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you just put a biscuit in your tea, right? So I like having, I think Twitter is so great for comedians. That'd be that's a comedy thought, isn't it? That's a sketch, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
And Twitter's great because you can have these, it's almost like if we didn't have Twitter, all these thoughts would be in our brain just piling up like a pressure cooker. Now I can tweet it. I never have to think about it again. It's gone. The idea's out there now. So I like, and I'm a procrastinator, huge procrastinator. I can't do anything without doing 10 other small, unrelated and random tasks first. So Twitter is wonderful. So if I've got to sit down and I've got to like edit something, I've got an editing job to do now and I've been putting it off like all week and I've been just doing bits of it, but I've got to finish it today. And before I sit down to do it, I'm going to go on Twitter. I'm going to blast out like three tweets. and I'm going to sit down and do the job. And that will work fine for me.
And those tweets, when you write them, will you just be writing whatever comes to your mind, or will you actually deliberate, think about it, and then post?
I very rarely deliberate. They're normally, like I said, it's very stream of conscience. And it's not even like I'm going to tweet today. It normally just comes into my brain. I'm like, oh, I'm going to put that. Like, I like it. It entertains me. And I like the banter. Twitter's a great record of our thoughts. I mean, that Black Mirror episode where someone gets resurrected but as like an android, and they use their social media to kind of get his speech right. I mean, that's Twitter, isn't it? Mm. I've done about 51,000 tweets in my Twitter career. So you could use my Twitter account and just clone me. But in a weird way, I like that. I like that there's a record of my brain out there online. That's weird, right?
Well, there's an article I read recently where I think that's where we're heading in terms of social media companies. They're going to clone either your tweets or your DMs, et cetera, and then use that to create your future social media profile once you're dead. It's insane.
Or
they'll communicate on your behalf as you, having cloned all your historic messages.
And imagine that they're funnier than me. Like, just imagine if they're better and just sharper, you know, like there's always someone who's like that much comes up. You know, someone does a tweet and it's just brilliant. And you think, I wish I'd written that. That's so great. So yeah, that'd be really annoying if they did a better version of me than me. But they could, with that much data, that could easily be done. Yeah, absolutely. Which is like, I don't find it scary though. I think it's great. A public record of all of our thoughts. I mean,
I go the opposite way with it. I'm still quite private in that respect. I don't necessarily want people to know all my thoughts and opinions.
Ah, but then don't forget, I'm very particular about what ones I share.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
when I understand that. Yeah. When you hear read the tweets of Dead Athena, it's not the real thing. It's just what she wanted to show you.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
And all the other dark, scary stuff will go. I'll take that to
the grave. Yeah. Perfect.
Hello, sorry to interrupt in the middle of this insightful conversation, which I'm enjoying, I'm sure, just as much as you are. But I need to give you guys a little reminder. If you like this conversation, this episode, if you like Balancing Acts in general, then please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it makes the world of difference. And the more reviews we get, the more rates we get, the more people can discover the podcast and we can make it go viral, whatever that means. Okay, back to the chat.
So you obviously, you've got your own podcast, Keeping Athena Company. I wanted to ask you, and it kind of ties in with Twitter, because I respect that you put things out there and you are able to debate with people about different subject matters. In terms of your guests on your podcast, and I ask this just from my own recent personal experience, would you actively invite people on who have a very different view and opinion on things, whether it be political or otherwise, for conversation? And if so, would you be concerned that you would be giving them a platform to air opinions that you don't necessarily abide or agree with?
Yes, I would. I think I have had people on who we hold different positions on things, because everyone on my podcast is someone I consider a friend or a professional friend, at least as a minimum. So I wouldn't have someone incredibly objectionable on my podcast, because the concept of the podcast is people literally come to keep my company. Like, they're just friends that hang out with me.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I guess I wouldn't deliberately do something like that to get like attention. I think that I'm not right about everything. So the barometer of, you know, righteousness isn't whether or not you agree with me or not. So if someone disagrees with me on something, that wouldn't disqualify them automatically from the podcast. I think, I guess the way you're going with this is, you know, is it worth platforming alternative views that are, you know, the consensus is that they're unprogressive? The answer is, well, no. If the consensus is they're unprogressive views, then why would you want people to keep talking about them? I think there's a fairly fine, not fine, I think there's a fairly well-defined line between decent person and dickhead. I get bored that there's this denial of this line. Like, it's a really clear line that separates good people from fucking annoying people. And people who are on the annoying side of the line, I think, you know, we need to stop having this kind of deliberation about them. Like, they're just cunts, excuse my language. And so would I have a cunt on my podcast? Well, no, I wouldn't be friends with one. But at the same time, I mean, if you've seen my podcast, I've got all kinds of people in my podcast who come from all walks of life. It's not just me interviewing creatives. I've got friends who are writers and psychologists and yeah. all kinds of lovely stuff. All kinds of lovely things, PhD students and things. So it's about conversation, and conversation doesn't happen with people who are exactly, or it does happen, but it's not as interesting if you've got two people who are exactly the same, right? I welcome like challenge for most of my views. I've got views people that are like, I don't like the EU. I'm a Remainer, but the EU is a horrible institution. It was infuriating in 2016 when people were like, oh my God, I don't want to use the EU. The EU is amazing. Like, the EU lets fucking immigrants drown in the Mediterranean every day. The EU is a white supremacist project. It was
it almost became romanticized, and you know, and this is probably going to sound controversial as well, but that also is applicable to, you know, areas of the NHS. It's not just all always been like this dream. There's parts of it that have been bloated over the years as well. Obviously I love the NHS, but I feel like sometimes people can forget these things or just wash over them, you know.
It's narrative. It makes sense to say the NHS is great. But, you know, about 10, 15 years ago, they spent £10 billion on an IT system that didn't work. I think, you know, people are starting to have a conversation now about empire and NHS. If there's no empire, there's no NHS. Similarly, if there's no immigrant labour, there was no NHS. You know, everyone's like, oh, you know, it's so great that these Windrush people came to be nurses. It's like, that was a demand you made. On these, you know, you saw us as resources, and you know, it's not like that was our dream. You're right, the word romanticizing is very accurate and apt. So there's loads, you know, there's loads that people might, you know, talk to me. I'm not a socialist. I don't like Jeremy Corbyn. You know, that used to get people's backs up. When people said he's unelectable, I was like, yes, he is. He's clearly unelectable. He can't make a decision. You have to be a very particular kind of leader when you're leader of the opposition. You can't be a real leader because you have no power. So I think people would say, I'm sure he would have made a good prime minister as it happens, but he wasn't a good leader of the opposition, which is a different job. People forgot that. I myself had lots of opinions that people didn't share, or I have lots of opinions that people don't share. So I welcome that, because that's conversation. Conversation isn't, yes, I agree, brilliant. Yes, I agree, brilliant. Well, join me next time and keep leading the company where I agree with people. And also I think it's a really good sign when you know people who disagree with you. Because why would you want to know people who just agreed with you all the time? Like, I think it's a good thing to have circles that have to have variety in your circle. It's not like I go around looking for people to disagree with. I'm not like one of these people always looking for a fight, but I don't judge people by their opinions. I might judge people based on their interpretation of facts. You know, I don't like anti-vaxxers. You know, I will judge them. We share different opinions, but the issue isn't the different opinions. The issue is they're looking at facts and they're throwing them out the window. So that's really odd to me. I don't mind people being cynical about vaccines. Why shouldn't we be cynical about them? It's all a bit quick. but anti-vaxxers annoy me. Forgotten the question, but I guess.
Did you grow up in a household that encouraged debate?
That's an interesting question. I think so. Yeah, I've got a twin brother. That's good.
I didn't know that. So that's part of the privacy there, is it? I had no idea. Or is that something you put out before?
That's interesting. No, I talk about it in my stand up, but I guess.
I missed that.
But I wouldn't generally, I don't, again, like I don't go, I'm a twin, hashtag twin. It's like, you know, I don't make a big deal about it.
You close?
So yeah, more so now. He lives in Australia now. Oh, but wow. We had babies on the same day a couple of years ago. So we had my first, he had his first at the same time, same day. So that made us closer for sure.
Is that a common occurrence between twins? I feel like it's not, but it should be.
Common. I should make a bigger deal out of this. It's a fucking
that is the ridiculous.
It's just like, if I go into it, I won't go into it, but it's just like everything. Like my baby was really late. His was like a little early and stuff. But it's a mad coincidence.
That's crazy.
I keep forgetting that I haven't gotten over it. I haven't gotten over how mad the coincidence was yet. It's just incredible. So when I was pregnant with my second, my first thought was, please don't be pregnant. Have your girlfriend not be pregnant right now, because it would just be awful. We can't be that in sync. Do you know what I mean? One time is fine, but there's two times people will think we text, you know, people think we you know, we're fucking WhatsApping each other while we're doing the deed. So it's not, so luckily it wasn't the case. But are we close? No, I would say it wasn't necessarily debate, but I would say I engendered my own critical thought processes through my interest as a young person. So I used to like to read a lot. I was always quite a questioning person. And that was generally encouraged in my household, like, educating yourself. And we had to do a lot of homeschooling at home. So we went to school and we'd come home, we'd have to do more fucking school. Like, that, you know, my mum and my dad would go to W. H. Smith and buy all those, like, but, you know, you get like education books, like textbooks, whatever. You could just, yeah, so we'd have to do that. So I think that probably made me a bit more open to debate and conversation and stuff as I got older. Mm. But we weren't the kind of household where we'd sit around the table and discuss the news. You know, it wasn't like that at all. We liked movies and music, so, and computers and computer games. But I was generally always a bit thirsty for knowledge, and I was always questioning things. So that was probably where it comes from.
And you still read loads now?
I tried to. It's hard, man, when you've got a couple of kids. I don't read as much as I used to. But I've literally got like five or six books piled up that I need to get through that I didn't read last year. But yeah, I'm definitely a champion of reading, which is really difficult. Do you know the average reading age of this country is about 12? You know that?
I did not.
This is true. Yeah. So the reason I say that is because sort of last year when we was all kind of beside ourselves thinking about race and inequality, we were saying, well, everyone read a book, and not everyone has that option because a lot of these books are not accessible like to 12-year-olds. So I do think reading is such a important thing to establish early in life, because most of the answers we seek are in books.
Yeah.
You know, this is just the reality. Most of the
one thing that I've been toying with recently, or just trying to mull over, is that you can read, well, there's books and then there's articles, and in articles somebody expresses an opinion on a subject matter, and then you read another article and it's the complete opposite. And yeah. So then how do you work through that to decide your view on those two things, but also find a way to create an original view or an original opinion based on all those materials?
Well, you've almost asked, how do you write a joke? You know, how do you create, how do you get an angle on something? I'm not going to answer your question, but I'm going to give you an example of something. So do you remember when Donald Trump was having his state visit and everyone was protesting it?
Yeah.
My position at the time was, you're all embarrassing yourselves. We have state visits all the time from people who are horrible, and you only care about Trump because you understand about America, but you don't understand about Saudi Arabia and all these other places. Mm. And then I was like, how hypocritical to say we don't want Trump to come here because he's racist. Because, like, Britain is not a racism-free zone. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's not like he's going to go through customs and they're going to stop him because, sorry, Donald Trump, you've got some quite unsavory views there. And I wrote this joke about how we didn't want Trump to come because he's like, you know, because we invented racism and he's got, like, Prosecco racism. We're like champagne racists, you know, and we're Prosecco racists. And okay. The reason I'm just relaying that bit of that is, like, that's an angle, isn't it? That's kind of like, you would read an article saying Trump is horrible, shouldn't be allowed here. You'd read an article saying Trump should be allowed here because everyone's allowed. But actually the view is he's an awful person, but at the same time, it's not going to achieve much pointing at people and saying they're awful when they're coming to a place which is awful. And at the time Trump was coming here, you know, people were being deported to their deaths. It's staggering. You know, people were literally being dragged out of their homes with 2 weeks' notice, put onto planes, sent to countries of quote unquote origin, which were not countries of origin, but that's what the time of us said, and they were left to die. And we were protesting Trump, you know? So it's all about, I think what you have to be is a truth seeker. Which sounds horrible because it actually sounds like a kind of somebody put tin foil on their head and, you know, like, you can handle the truth kind of nutcase. But you just have to kind of, you know, when you're making a fish curry, you always squeeze half a lemon in at the end, cuts through the fat, makes it taste really nice. And you want to be that half a lemon. You want to cut through the fat and you want to say, well, this is noise, but when we dial it down, what's really going on here? And the only thing that, you know, the only way you could get through that is just kind of like being able to absorb information objectively and with knowledge. you know, so I have knowledge of what racism is and where it comes from. I know that racism is a very British thing. It's incredibly British. Nothing is more British than racism. And Britain literally invented racism through stuff called the Barbados Slave Codes. This is history. I happen to know that we have state visits for all kinds of people because they're not nice, but they have lots of money and we want money as a state. I know some to know that, not, you know, white middle class people love to say they hate racism, but they love to do nothing about it.
I was going to ask you on that, you know, with what, everything that went on with BLM, etc. Quite a few of my friends who are black and work in comedy, or not even work in comedy, to be honest, when I was talking to them about it, were tired of white people asking what they can do to help and if they're okay. What was your kind of reaction to that? Were you encouraging that, or and if they did ask what they can do to help, what was your answer?
Was it tiring? It was a very weird couple of weeks for a while. I think it suddenly felt like I described it as being fluent in a language no one else understood. And then overnight, everyone understood the language. And so imagine not ever being heard and then all of it and understood. And all of a sudden, everyone is like, so Athena, and you're like, wow, that you didn't. Before that, was I speaking no racism? I don't understand. And all of a sudden, it's like, I understand. So that was just like a bit overwhelming, you know? My answer to anybody who says, what can I do? What can I do? And I'm just like, put money in black people's pockets. Not literally, of course. The racism we have in the world globally, well, let's talk about UK, is so structural and so embedded into systems. It is not even conceivable that you or me or anyone as an individual could do anything about it. It's inconceivable. This racism is centuries old. It's in the systems we have. It's in the education system. It's in the law system. I was telling someone the other day, I have this joke basically. And the joke basically, my mum's Indian. And the joke was, when I was born, I was the only black person in the room. And the whole point of the joke was to explain, I'm cool being the only black person here. I was born that way. But then one day after a gig, someone came up to me and said, that joke about having a single mum really cracked me up, right? It wasn't a joke about having a single mum, but because of racism, that person couldn't hear that joke without thinking I was talking about my dad being absent.
Right.
You know? I was just doing a silly joke about my mum being Indian and therefore, and an assumption that the doctors are white, so I'm the only black person in the room. It was never, but because of racism, and that's what I mean, like everything that you've ever learned in your life, that's been absorbed deliberately or undeliberately or indeliberately, whatever the word is making you come to a conclusion you don't even realize are offensive, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one example. Think of the many thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of ideas and opinions and that people have that, I mean, there's 60 million of us in this country. So what I'm trying to say is, as an individual, there's nothing you can do to change that. But what we can do is kind of outmaneuver it. So put money back in people's office, amplify black people, give black people work, shop in black businesses. Where do you put your money? Capitalism and racism go hand in hand. So think about, do you need to upgrade your phone every year? Are you throwing too much stuff away? Are you consuming too much stuff? Leading an anti-capitalist life and anti-racist life are the two things. But I think it does come down to what you can do as an individual. And that is, what can we do? How do you spend our money? How can we put black people in pitch situations where they can be remunerated for the work that they do? And all the other stuff will have to just figure itself out in the wash. You know, it's so hard, but that's my, and it's not good advice, but that I'm giving, by the way, because I don't have the answers. My advice is terrible. I don't have the answers. Just to be positive, like a lot of the work I was doing last year and a lot of the opportunities I have, and I say positive, but it isn't that positive, but it is a good thing, came from people wanting to make a change to their writers' rooms and to the way it worked. I mean, there are some jobs that I did that I've been trying to do for ages. And then I did them and it was like, oh, this is not even a big deal. What was the problem? So I think it's made people question why they interrogate the inclusion of black and brown people into spaces more than white people, which is good. So there was a reaction, certainly, that I benefited from. But, like I said, that is what I would say to people who ask what they can do. And it's not even the right answer. It's just an answer.
Yeah, but it's a starting point, at least, isn't it? You won the BBC Felix Dexter bursary. which was obviously that's quite a big thing. But did you find the term for it being described as a BAME up and coming comedy writers problematic?
Felix Dexter's not BAME. He's a black man.
Okay? Right.
So
right.
I do find the term BAME problematic, and it's not often used in the correct way.
Mm.
If the BBC wants to offer a bursary for all people who aren't white, that's fair enough. But Felix Dexter suffered from a specific kind of racism, an anti-black racism. But, you know, so that would be my observation on that. Like, if you really wanted to address Felix Dexter's issue, and everyone, I think their consensus is he's, you know, one of the finest comedians we've produced, that why he didn't get his own sitcoms, why he wasn't Mr. Saturday Night, we'll never know. Well, we do know, because he was black. It wasn't because he was BAME. So if we want to talk about that, then, then that's it. However, you know, at the same time, that's, you know, diversity is diversity. Anyone who gets that award, if they're not white, that's, there is a benefit. What you're supposed to do, have an award for everyone? Like, mm-hmm, but if, you know, if that award was constructed to benefit, to talk about the barriers he faced, it should probably be a black award. But I'm not necessarily against it being open to BAME people. I think it highlights the problem with the word BAME is that when you use that word, it very rarely addresses the subject you're talking about. Actually, I'll give you an example. I read a Guardian article a couple of days ago. It was about vaccine cynicism in the Muslim community. It's very clear. I read the article, and it spoke to various Muslim representatives and members of the community, of various Muslim communities. And it was about Muslim conversations about the vaccine. And the headline was, BAME people aren't taking the vaccine, which is not what the article was about. You know, if they'd gone to an Asian person, a South Asian person, an East Asian person, a black person, a Mexican person, a Venezuelan person, a Filipino, then call it BAME. You've listed loads of people.
Yeah, they're just lumping everyone into one.
Precisely. Into that one category. And also you're not addressing the particular problem which the article was about, which is there was a particular narrative around the vaccine that is putting off Muslim people, there's a rumor that the vaccines have pork in them, incident that they're not halal. So that's not a BAME issue, that's a Muslim issue, right? Yeah. And by the way, white people can be Muslim, so even saying BAME is just silly. Like, half of, you know, Eastern Europe is Muslim, they're white people. So it's very, very strange terminology. I think people use the word BAME because they're hiding from, people never like to use the word black. If someone wants to find me in a room, they'll be like, oh, there's a, give it to the girl in the white shirt. But if you really want to find me, just say, give it to the black girl in the white shirt. Do you know what I mean? That's like way, but people don't like, and so I think BAME comes from that.
There's a brilliant sketch on that, by the way. Have you come across Ty Campbell?
I think it's Ty Campbell. Yes.
He did a brilliant sketch on that.
I know exactly the sketch you're talking about. Yeah.
It's so good.
Ty's great. We don't like it. The other thing as well is white supremacy is a really interesting thing, that we all hate it, but we all do things that uphold it. And the idea there's a line, and white people are on one side of the line and everyone else on the other side is just fucking garbage. Like, we are not deviations from whiteness, but the term BAME implies that we are. We are the global majority. If anything, we need a name for white people. You know, like, it's really, that really enforces the idea that, like I said, you're not white, so you're just something else. And it's like, well, what's that something else? I think that there is still space to use that word because white supremacy still exists. So sometimes we do need to talk about something. We do need to say things like, when people say BAME people are more likely to die from COVID, that's probably a correct thing to say. However, you then need to say, well, to what degrees? You know, who is more or less likely to, but so there's a space for it, but there isn't so much space that matches the frequency that I see it used with now, you know. And it is worrying that we haven't got to a stage where we're being specific about what we're talking about when it comes to people who are not white. Because let me put it to you, we're in Europe, there's probably about 300 million people in Western Europe,
mm-hmm.
Most of whom are white. Many, some are not. There were a billion people in China. There's a billion people in India. You know, like, it's you. What if you're embarrassing yourselves by trying to say, "Oh, you lot over there"? Like, no, it's you lot over there. It's you. None of you. There's hardly any of you. You know, and to just kind of put us into one kind of box, you know, and we're in this massive, huge box and you guys are in this tiny little box because there's not that many of you guys, just globally. It's getting boring now, just culturally, economically, you know, people who aren't white are just so much, we just outnumber you and we just come in such huge quantities, which is a weird word to say with humans, weird quantities of humans, but I'll go with it, that, you know, BAMIs is a very obsolete term for most of the time when it's used, it's used in a very obsolete and unhelpful way. But going back to your question about Felix Dexter, you know, the BBC have decided that bursary should be open for everyone and anyone who gets it will benefit from it. So I don't object to that, but I do think it raises Felix Dexter's very particular issue with the industry, which is that he was a black man.
Mm. Did you find it useful being on that?
Paid. It's a bursary, right? So I got it.
So it wasn't a program as well, because you did the BBC Writers Room. So it wasn't like that kind of experience where they put you through different
areas. It wasn't. It was basically an opportunity to work on my pilot whilst getting a very modest bit of remuneration. Most of the time when we write, we're not getting paid.
Yeah.
So basically, to put it bluntly, it was development.
Okay.
You know, like, so yeah, and it was useful. It forced me to quit my job. I would not have quit my job if I
had. Okay, that was a catalyst.
Yeah. Because it was right. It was full time. I had to be present full time. So it wasn't possible to do both jobs. It gave me huge confidence. It definitely, when, you know what I was talking about earlier about you look at your credentials and it helps you combat imposter syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
It made me really able to be in places and feel like, oh, I'm not just on work experience now. Like, this is, I go to the BBC every day. I can photocopy for free. You know what I mean? I can steal their notepads. This is my job now. Like, so I was better, you know, I did some of my best work last year, I think, purely, not because I had creatively become better, but just my brain was like, this is what you do for a living now. You know, someone's read something and decided that this makes you worthy of this kind of investment. And that kind of encouragement gave me huge confidence when I was, you know, writing stuff for people and being in certain writers' rooms and whatever. And also to develop further projects, because I've written two more scripts since then, which I would never would have written, you know, without that encouragement. And so of course it's going to help you. If you're a writer and someone says, you're so good, we're going to pay you for 6 months to continue writing, and then we're going to, you know, really champion you.
Mm-hmm.
Then if that doesn't help you, you're in trouble, man. Like, you know, I'm not going to say, oh, you do it and you'll get, I mean, nothing, the project went nowhere, by the way. Like, it's not okay. Like, as projects tend not to
yeah,
do.
They rarely
like
do, that, yeah.
Yeah. Which just goes to show, like, what I went, the support I had, and it was still like, you know, computer says no. But the, you know, that I still had loads of other stuff come out of it that more than made up for that disappointment. Yeah.
And what would be the one, if you had one takeaway from the BBC Writers Room experience, what would be the one takeaway in terms of something that you learned technically that you've since applied to your writing projects?
Oh, technically. Character.
Okay.
You know, yeah, character. If you have good characters, that you're halfway to writing your jokes, you're halfway to writing funny stuff. But if you're, as a comedian, what you try to do first is you try to write your jokes and you don't think about character so much. But one of the things I was really supported to do whilst on the bursary and whilst doing the writer's room was just watch as much comedy as well. And I watched comedy before, but really watch it.
Mm.
And you start to see the consistencies that certain amazing sitcoms have, for example, because sitcom writing was kind of what I was going to and still am. And character's the big one. And what I actually just read this on Twitter, and I apologize, I don't remember the person who said it. It was off of a Twitter thread that someone was sharing about writing advice. And it was, I just remembered it because it was consistent with what I learned. And it basically was like, make your characters so strong and so bold, they sound ridiculous. It's the actor's job to make them not sound ridiculous. It's your job to just be bold and blatant. And once I learned to make my writing really unsubtle, that was like opening a safe. And I was like, oh, an embarrassment of comedy riches. And then you look at all your favorite comedies. One of my favorite comedies is Kimmy Schmidt, right? All the characters there are ridiculous. Like, imagine writing these like Titus. You know, he's ridiculous. I'd have been there going, he loves Barbies. That's ridiculous. And now I'm like, oh my God, your characters have to be so ridiculous when you're writing funny stuff. And then your actors will be so good. You only realize they're ridiculous. So
that's
character,
a great
character,
point.
Character.
That's a really good
character,
point.
Character, yeah.
And I haven't thought about it that way before. But that's really, really interesting. Okay, I'm going to ask you two more questions because I've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you for sitting and chatting with me. First is, I know you're a voracious reader. So are there any books that stand out to you that have had a massive impact on you over the course of your life? And it doesn't have to be related to comedy or writing, just, and that's quite general.
Yeah. I'm just going to do the two bits that come to my head. And it's so random. So this is, the first one is a book, a very famous book called The English Patient by Michael Ndaarchi, who's a wonderful writer. And you might have seen the film. It's a great film. It's a great book. Michael Ndaarchi is such a good writer that there are scenes that he writes about in that book that I still have visions of in my brain. And I don't know why I thought of that. I must have just seen the book on a bookshelf. But that would be one book. So I highly recommend that book. Really good book. Great film. But it's a really great book. So that's not, and it's not inspired. You know, I don't wake up every day and look at The English Patient. What a great, you know, it's just, but if someone, as a creative, you know, I just think he achieved something with that book that's really special. And in terms of plot as well, great story. It's a wicked story. Okay. So that's a random one for you, but it's a great book. A second book, Their Eyes Were Watching God, I think, by Zora Neale Hurston, because it's just, again, really good book. If someone wants to read a book, to read like a pro-black book, you know, it's Black Lives Matter. I'll go back to your question about what do I recommend. I definitely recommend reading black art that has fuck all to do with racism. You know what I mean? Like, don't just go out and read a book about, you know, why I don't talk to white people about race, blah, blah, blah. Read a black book that is just about a woman who gets married, then gets divorced, which is what Their Eyes Are Watching God is about. Because guess what? We don't wake up every day and talk about racism. We're made out of the same stuff as everyone else, and we just do that. And can I give you a third book?
Of course,
My Sister the Serial Killer is a really good example of that. Like, we just live. You know what I mean? Like, we don't live as black people. We just live. And a really good way to engender that and to just get that into our brains is to consume the art we make that has nothing to do with race, that is about our lives and our world and our cultures. And so Their Eyes Are Watching God and My Sister the Serial Killer are two great novels to just enjoy. Don't learn. You know what I mean? Don't feel guilty. And you're giving writers, those two writers, money too. One has passed away, sadly, but her estate hopefully will get that money. That's what I'd say.
All right, fantastic. And I lied. I have actually got, there's one more question, which I should have asked you earlier. It was because it's part of the theme of the podcast. What do you do outside of your work? What do you do to unwind, relax? Are you a spiritual person? Do you meditate? What's your vibe, Athena?
I cook.
Okay.
Yeah, I do like to get in the kitchen. I like to cook. I'm starting to get back into I used to train a lot. I call it training, not exercise. That's how deep it was. Was I competing anywhere? No. Did anyone care? No. But, so I'm getting back into that now, especially because I'm not having any more children. So I'm getting, putting more time into my day to do my yoga and do that. I find that quite a thing. I know it sounds boring, but parenting is just the most wonderful thing. I carve out time to spend with my kids during the day. You know, there's nothing, teaching a child the alphabet, it's just fucking brilliant. You know what I mean? It's just lovely. It's wonderful. I get more out of it than they do. So parenting is, you know, really, I know it's supposed to parent. I shouldn't really say it's my pastime, but I do make a real point of kind of saying this is me and baby time now. And I do that. Yeah. What else? I watch a lot of TV now. I watch a lot of comedy and movies. Me and my partner, we just watch a lot. And I call it homework, so it's okay to do.
I completely agree with you. Even when I switch off and I'm not analysing it, because there are some times where I will switch off and I'll just be sucked into the show.
Yeah.
I guess subconsciously you're always taking things in, aren't you?
Oh, you're always. Even if it's just admiration. you know, even if it's just admiration. So, and sometimes admiration is, how did you get to film that? It's shit. How did you get the green light? It's rubbish. You know, sometimes it's like, if that got the green light, then I gotta, you know, the stuff is gonna happen for me. So sometimes it's like, sometimes that I get that kind of encouragement as well. But yeah, I mean, I do loads. I like to be outside. I mean, holidays and just going out. It's some of the things that I used to do the most, we can't do anymore. Just going to get, I was saying to a friend, like, I miss going out for a pizza. You know, I miss this hanging out with two people, eating a really big pizza and drinking a glass of wine and stuff like that. Like boring, ordinary middle-class shit. So hopefully that'll come back. But I do, you've got to walk away from your desk. You definitely got to walk away from your desk every now and again.
100%. 100%. Final question is, what does the idea of balance mean to you or not?
Balance is actually, for me, about expectations, you know, like what you expect out of your day. You know, you're not what you expect out of what you're going to achieve. Our chances of success as writers are really low. As in authored commissioned writers, I think as writers in writers' rooms and stuff like that, I think, you can get a foot into the industry and fine, but our chances of success in terms of like getting shit made and whatever, they're still quite low. So it sounds a bit boring, but you've got to make sure you get joy from other places. You know, you've got to make sure other things give you joy. And if they don't, find something, even if it's other people's success or another skill or whatever. So balance is that, but all that links to expectations. So just, I manage my expectations about everything. I manage my expectations about my breakfast. You know, I manage my, you know, like, oh, I might burn the toast today. So just manage your expectations for everything and be realistic and find joy in places other than the things that, you know, when you're not in control of something, you can be in control of a lot of what you do, but when you're not in control, you need to be finding joy in things you have complete control over. That helps a lot.
That is a superb answer. Where is best for people to follow you and keep up with your work and what you're up to?
Well, go and find the picture of the rainbow and find out the park that I live near and find me there.
There is your mission.
That's your, it's like a little treasure hunt. My podcast is called Keeping Within the Company. Super easy to find. And I guess like follow me on Twitter. I'm very easy to find. Come say hello on Twitter. That'd be cool. Yeah, that'd be nice.
Great. Athena, thanks so much. Been great speaking with you.
It's been a pleasure.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.